Live? Yes, okay. So thank you for the invitation, and I suppose I'm changing the subject from the first part of the morning. So since I'm changing the subject, let me begin with what is quark gluon plasma? And my operational definition is, when I say quark gluon plasma, I mean matter, bulk matter, in or at least close to thermal equilibrium at a temperature that's somewhere above the QCD transition. And I warn you that this transition in quotes is in fact a smooth crossover, which occurs in a narrow range of temperatures somewhere around 170 MeV. So how might we probe the properties of this stuff? As far as static or thermodynamic quantities are concerned, from the theoretical side, lattice QCD is a great tool. This is a problem that the thermodynamics of the quark gluon plasma is very well suited to theoretical study with lattice QCD. Can someone turn some of these lights down? It seems to me anyway that some of these front lights should come down. Yeah, thank you. So what do we learn from lattice QCD? Well, one of the things we learn is what I already told you. If you look at the number of degrees of freedom, which you can evaluate by calculating on the lattice the energy density over T to the fourth, you find that that number of degrees of freedom is small, below TC, say 3 for a pion gas. It then rises continuously but rapidly in a narrow range of temperatures up to some value up here, which is about 80% that of the ideal non-interacting quark gluon plasma gas. And notice that it gets up to here quite quickly and then is rather flat. You can also evaluate many other quantities like the chiral condensate, but I'll just leave you with that one to keep in mind. So if, given that QCD features a crossover and not a sharp transition, then if you start thinking about an experimental program like the relativistic heavy ion collider, there's no yes-no question for that experimental program to answer. You have to state the goals as follows. You need to create matter that's above the crossover and study its properties. Now, when here I say create matter, I mean to create not just a bunch of particles, but to create some condensed matter type state, some macroscopic region with it, which is in local thermal equilibrium or approximate local thermal equilibrium. And the news from Rick, now several years old, is that Rick data on a quantity, which I'll tell you about on the next transparency, actually is telling us that the interactions in this stuff are sufficiently strong that you get approximately equilibrated matter expanding collectively as a fluid by a remarkably early time of order 1 Fermi or even less. And after that time, so after the first Fermi, ideal hydrodynamics, which means the bold assumption of zero mean free path, the assumption that you have an ideal liquid, not an ideal gas at all, that this crazy approximation describes the bulk of the particles in the collision surprisingly well. The second thing that Rick data tells us is that at a time of 1 Fermi, the energy density is greater than 5 GeV per cubic Fermi. I won't walk you through how we learned this. It's straightforward. This one is not in question at all. So I'm not going to walk you through how you get this from data, but there's no question about this. This one is more interesting, so I'll talk more about number one. But the point of this transparency is to say that really the situation in Rick physics is that we understand that we have one and two, and so people are busy doing three, namely studying the properties of this stuff. Let me just go back and show you where is 5 GeV per cubic Fermi on this transparency. 5 GeV per cubic Fermi is right there. So what we've learned from Rick is that at about 1 Fermi after the collision, you have a rapidly expanding volume of stuff, which is behaving as a fluid and has a temperature, as an energy density, excuse me, somewhere around here. So you're above the crossover, but not far above it. So now, the piece that I said I would tell you more about is what's the evidence of early equilibration. And this will be my first, and historically the first, example of an interaction between experiment and ADS-CFT calculations. And it is today, to this day, I think the best example. The main part of my talk will be about newer examples, but let me go through the old example quickly. So the experimental observable you look at is you select after the fact, you select collisions which collided at non-zero impact parameter. So there was a nucleus going into the board, a nucleus coming out of the board. They collided in an almond-shaped region. And if the hypothesis you want to rule out is that all that happened in that red region was a bunch of independent PP collisions with nothing happening afterwards, bunch of particles free-streaming outwards from 100 PP collisions that happen to occur in that red spot. Well, if so, if that's what happened, then your final state from 100 PP collisions would be azimuthally symmetric. On the other hand, if you have here a hot fluid, which explodes, behaves collectively, then this is called a shaped charge. This is how, when you design explosives, if you make the explosive in this shape, it will blast out with greater force left and right than up and down, because the pressure gradients are greater left to right than they are up to down. And so you should then get an azimuthally non-symmetric final state. And the measure of the azimuthal non-asymmetry is this quantity called V2, which I won't even bother to define for you. It turns out to be non-zero in the data. Well, you have to compare it to something. What you compare it to are these black boxes, which are the calculations of ideal hydrodynamics, assuming zero mean free path, perfect local equilibrium. And the amazing thing is how well that works. It doesn't work perfectly, but there's no reason why it should. This ideal hydrodynamics is based on this crazy assumption of local equilibrium from t equals zero. Why should it work so well? It's never worked before. Before Rick, it missed always by about a factor of two or more. What this means quantitatively is that, well, people have analyzed the degree of agreement and turned that into two statements. One is that hydrodynamics seems to work by this early time. The other thing you can do with this is you can ask, well, how small must the shear viscosity be? Because viscosity, if the viscosity is large, that means that you don't have a system that behaves like a perfect fluid. Viscosity parameterizes the deviation from perfect fluid. And Derek Tini extracted this dimensionless ratio of shear viscosity to entropy density from Rick data and found it to be less than of order a tenth. If this were a different audience, we could go through this estimate. It's being challenged. Maybe this one-tenth should be two-tenths or three-tenths, but it's still very, very small. Very, very small if you compare it to water, which is, of course, the fluid that hydrodynamics is named after. Water has 8 over S of about 10. So the quark-gluon plasma, regardless of details, has between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude smaller shear viscosity than water. It's a better liquid than water. Well, should we be surprised if the quark-gluon plasma is a liquid? The first answer is no, because after all, at temperatures a few times TC, the coupling is certainly not small. But the reason why there was a collective surprise was people in the heavy ion community had been misled by this lattice result, which seems to suggest that, look, hey, we're at 80% of the value for an ideal quark-gluon plasma, so this presumably is a quark-gluon plasma where interactions are a small 20% correction. And the ADS-CFT calculation taught us the following lesson. It was a calculation in a different theory, n equals 4 supersymmetric QCD. But this theory has its quark-gluon plasma. And in the strong coupling limit, the shear 8 over S for this theory turns out to be 1 over 4 pi, as these authors showed. And the energy density over T to the fourth of this theory turns out to be 75% of its value in a non-interacting quark-gluon plasma of this theory. So what this theory provided was an example of a theory where you could rigorously, from first principles, calculate both the thermodynamics, namely epsilon over T to the fourth, and the dynamics, namely the shear viscosity, and see that there was an example where very, very strong interactions, shear viscosity ridiculously small, leads to only a 25% correction of the energy density. So after the fact, after the data, now nobody is surprised anymore. It's the accepted wisdom in the field that the quark-gluon plasma is a liquid. And after the fact, in this case after the string theorists, what we realize is that 80% is closer to 75% than it is to 1. So when from the lattice we saw, now several decades ago actually for the first time, when we saw from the lattice an energy density that's 80% that of Stefan Boltzmann, we should never have thought that this meant weak interactions. So this is a really nice story. Okay, this is a story that's now a couple of years old, several years old. And let me just review very quickly what the issues are. Obviously, the two theories are different. What are the differences, and do they matter? Well, n equals 4 is supersymmetric, but supersymmetry is broken at non-zero temperature, so maybe I shouldn't worry about that too much. The n equals 4 theory has 16 adjoint degrees of freedom. QCD has 2. But this difference cancels in the ratio 8 over S. So maybe I shouldn't worry about that too much. N equals 4 has no quarks. Now, Bushell, Liu, and Starnet showed that this ratio is 1 over 4 pi in any gauge theory with a gravity dual, including many theories that do have fundamentals. Of course, nobody's shown that this is true in QCD, but It's at least now been shown in many other gauge theories with fundamentals. Yes? The statement from these people, I don't know whether there are examples of gauge theories with gravity duals, which are on both sides of the divide that you just mentioned. The statement is that if there is a gravity dual, then it works. So I don't know the answer, actually. Now, the biggest problem, I would say, is that eta over s is calculated for nc goes to infinity, and nobody has been able to calculate 1 over nc corrections to the ADS CFT calculations. That's a really hard problem. Now, what's another? There's two more differences. N equals 4 theory is conformal. QCD is not. Of course, QCD is very non-conformal for temperatures below TC. There are many, many scales in town having to do with all of the hadrons. At T goes to infinity, when asymptotic freedom sets in, QCD is also not conformal. But there's a range of temperatures between, say, 2 or even 1.5 TC and on up, where at least the thermodynamics looks very conformal. One example of this is the flatness of this line. But another example, less well known, if you look at the speed of sound in the quark-gluon plasma, in a conformal theory, the speed of sound is squared is 1/3. If you look at the speed of sound squared from lattice QCD, by about 2 TC, you're very, very close to speed of sound squared of 1/3. And even at 1.5 TC, you're not that far off. So QCD, the quark-gluon plasma, looks pretty conformal, at least as far as its thermodynamics is concerned, so maybe dynamics too. Finally, what about the larger TUF coupling? That's really not a worry. Of course, the original calculation is done for a TUF coupling of infinity. In the real world, in the quark-gluon plasma, if alpha is a half, the TUF coupling is 6 pi, which is about 19. And these folks calculated the non-infinite TUF coupling corrections, and at this value of the TUF coupling, they're really small. So this is a really pretty package. I don't think it all hangs together unless you have both the experiment and the theoretical insight from the ADS CFT side, but together it's a really nice package. So let's look for other such stories. So the other experimental discovery at RIC can be summarized at the picture level in this transparency. We learned from RIC data that this blob of quark-gluon plasma that you make when you collide two gold nuclei is opaque to hard partons. The picture suggested by the data is that if you have a hard collision where, in the absence of the red blob, you would have made a jet going this way and a jet going this way, they both get thermalized by the red blob. If the hard collision that would have made two jets occurs here, you see one jet coming out like this, but the one going in like this is killed. And then, of course, if there's a tangential case where you see two. So the ingoing and interior jets are getting quenched, is the term. So let me just show you the data that leads to that picture. There are a variety of ways of looking at it. I should stress that at RIC you don't actually see jets. What you see are the leading hadrons that in vacuum would have been jets. So you look, suppose you see in this case, I think it's a 5 to 6 GeV pion coming out at you. You then look at all of the pions, or all of the hadrons, you don't know they're the pions necessarily, you look at all of the hadrons with momenta bigger than 2, and you ask, what is their angular distribution relative to the high-energy one you saw? And you see that, statistically speaking, this is in a statistical sense the jet. This is averaged over many events. In a single event, you can't see a jet, but statistically, you find that there's a peak at 0 degrees. That means if I see a particle coming out at me, it's more likely to find other particles around it. You then go look at 180 degrees, and in proton-proton collisions or in proton-gold collisions, you see the backside jet, but in gold-gold collisions, you've discovered monojets. You see a jet coming out at you. At 180 degrees, there's nothing. This has been done. This is several years old now. It's been done. Very nice things have been done on the experimental side. You then go and redo the analysis, but on the far side, you look at very, very soft stuff with PT bigger than 150 MeV, and you find an enhancement. So what's happened is when you look on the far side, instead of seeing the hard jet, you see an excess of the soft stuff. So it's very, very direct. There was a hard parton going into that red muck, and it got turned into lots of soft things. You can do more, but what I want to turn to is to ask the question, what is it that we learn about this medium from asking how difficult is it for a hard parton to plow through it? How much energy does a hard parton lose when it plows through this red stuff? There's a perturbative formalism for calculating parton energy loss in the limit of a high energy parton. It's developed by many people, not including me. And the spectrum of energy radiated in gluons is described by diagrams that look like this. So here's my hard parton, and it loses energy by emitting a gluon. This gluon is also relatively hard to set scales. If you imagine at RIC, this parton had an energy of 20 GeV. It loses energy by radiating, say, 5 GeV gluons. That's where most of the energy loss comes from. But this is not happening in vacuum. This line, and this line are all repeatedly softly scattering off the medium. You can think of this in cartoon form as each time it scatters, it's given a transverse momentum, call it mu, and these scatterings happen once every distance, call it lambda. And in this formalism, when you calculate this spectrum, it turns out to be controlled by a single parameter, which for I have no idea why has been given the horrible name Q hat. It's the jet quenching parameter. And what is Q hat? Q hat is the amount of jiggle you get per distance traveled. So each of these hard red lines is getting jiggled by the medium, and Q hat is how much jiggle there is. And in calculating this energy loss, you have the hard part of the process, which is in red, the soft part of the process is in green. This description only makes sense if the energy E and this momentum transfer to the gluon K perp are large enough so that QCD is weakly coupled at these scales. So in this treatment, I'm assuming that red stuff is at a high enough energy scale that you can use weak coupling methods, but you can't get away from the green stuff. So this parton energy loss calculation is sensitive to the medium, to the strongly interacting physics that you're trying to study through one parameter Q hat, which is the amount of jiggle you get per distance traveled. The energy loss is controlled by this Q hat. The intuition then is that this Q hat is some mu squared over lambda. You can ask, what should mu be? It should be something like the inverse Debye length. What should lambda be? It's some mean free path. You put that together and you conclude that at an intuitive level, Q hat should be some measure of the number density of scatterers. And this is what everyone thought before our work. So you can extract Q hat from RIC data. Now, there's a long story to this, which I won't go through, but I'll just show you a plot here. So what is plotted here is a ratio called RAA versus PT. RAA is the ratio of the number of, say, 15 GeV pions that you see in gold-gold collisions versus what you would have gotten if you just had independent PP collisions. And you see that it's suppressed by about a factor of 5. That suppression comes from the fact that many of those ingoing jets have been killed. You can model this suppression using the formalism that I've sketched, and you can ask what Q hat fits the data. You can see here that Q hat of 1 GeV squared per Fermi doesn't work at all. 5 GeV squared per Fermi is not bad. 10 and 15 work also. If you go beyond 15, you start to be below the data. So this Q hat bar, which is being extracted from the data, is a time-averaged Q hat. Its relation to the Q hat as a function of time, so as the medium is expanding, Q hat is certainly changing. This depends on assumptions, but it's reasonable just to set scales. You can think of this Q hat bar being extracted from the data as roughly Q hat at a time of 1 Fermi. So this motivates, then, the need for a strong coupling calculation of Q hat. And of course, if somebody knew how to do this in QCD, we wouldn't need what I'm going to show you now, but nobody does. So let's do it in N equals 4. Now, how are we going to get there? You need one more step. This Q hat is related to the expectation value of a light-like adjoint Wilson loop. This was noted several years ago by my collaborator, Urs Wiedemann. What is this Wilson loop? It's a contour in which you have two long legs of length L minus going along the light cone. So you go up the light cone, then you come back, and you connect them in the distant future, in the distant past, with short legs L that are in perpendicular, transverse direction. So really, these short legs should be coming out of the board. It's hard to draw. So L here, the width in the transverse direction, is conjugate to K perpendicular. So you describe gluon emission with a KT that corresponds to this L. And this formalism only makes sense if KT is large. That means if L is small. In that limit, then, the adjoint Wilson loop at finite temperature is supposed to come out to be proportional to well, e to the minus something, where the something is proportional to L minus and L squared, and the proportionality constant is Q hat. For those of you who've actually read our paper on this, I apologize, we made an error here. There should be a root 2 there, which is missing in the paper on the archive. There will be a new version coming soon. The derivation of this result is non-trivial. I won't walk you through it, but it's partially correct to think of it as follows. Remember that diagram that I had, which was this. You want to evaluate a probability distribution. You have to square that diagram. That means you have this diagram and its conjugate. And you can think of the two Wilson lines here, one going up the light cone, the other one coming back, as the gluon line in the diagram and the gluon line in the conjugate diagram. That's a partially correct description of how you get from the calculation to this Wilson loop. Okay, but now you know, all this is motivation. By now, any of you could do the calculation. So we're going to use ADS-CFT to calculate that Wilson loop, of course, at in large NC, large Atuff coupling. This is a completely Minkowski space quantity. It's on the light cone. So it's inaccessible to lattice QCD as currently formulated. The prescription, well, first of all, there's a at large NC, the adjoint Wilson loop is just the square of the fundamental one. And then we use the prescription due originally to these authors here, that what we have to do is to find an extremal world sheet in a five-dimensional ADS black hole metric where the boundary of that world sheet is the Wilson loop contour C sitting at R equals infinity, R being the fifth dimension. So we have a new fifth dimension R. The real world, if you like, sits at large R. And at R0, there's a black hole horizon with some Hawking temperature, and that Hawking temperature is the gauge theory temperature. I'm assuming this setup is familiar to people in this room. For a different audience, I would have had to spend much more time on it. Now, there's something which maybe is less familiar, and that is, I want to get an answer that looks like this, and in the prescription, I have a prescription that looks like this. That means S needs to be imaginary. For S to be imaginary, the extremal world sheet extremizing this action has to be space-like. Is that a surprise? Well, if you've spent your time thinking about Wilson loops and ADS-CFT in the context of studying screening, it is a surprise to you because you're used to thinking of a Wilson loop, say, in the time-like direction, when in this case, S turns out to be real. So you can think of the Wilson loop as e to the I times something proportional this time. And then this E of R tells you about the screening, the screened interaction between a quark and an antiquark. So how then do I go from this to a space-like world sheet? In other words, if I start with this and start boosting the loop, what happens? Well, if you boost just a little bit, what happens first is that you study screening in a hot wind. That's an interesting subject that I don't have time to describe in this talk. It has implications for heavy ion phenomenology too. But then, for quarks of any finite mass, non-infinite mass, above some wind velocity, the screening length will become much less than the Compton wavelength of the quarks. At that point, two things happen. First of all, that turns out to be the place where the world sheet becomes space-like. And second of all, the physical interpretation of the Wilson loop changes because you're no longer studying a screened interaction. What are you studying? Well, you're studying deep inelastic scattering. It should be very familiar to some in the room that any time you describe high energy scattering in an Eichenholz approximation, you get Wilson lines. And so you can think then of the QQ bar, instead of being some crude description of a meson, it's a description of the QQ bar component of a virtual photon coming from a deep inelastic scattering process. So the short way of saying it is that Q hat describes deep inelastic scattering off the quark gluon plasma, which is, of course, an experiment that would be nice to do but can't be done. It turns out the nice thing is that the Q hat, the same Q hat that would describe deep inelastic scattering off the quark gluon plasma, which in that case would be called the saturation scale, describes the energy loss, as I've mentioned previously. Okay, so space-like imaginary actions are not scary. They happen. They're physically. They just have a different physical interpretation. So now let's do the calculation. Here's the setup. At large R, I put my Wilson loop. You should think of this as two rails coming out of the board. The light-like direction comes out of the board. The transverse direction of width L is shown. So I have two rails coming out of the board and a bed sheet hanging underneath them, and I have to find the shape of the bed sheet. I deliberately wrote the action in a way that you couldn't see it because you don't need to see it. I mean, the metric in a way you couldn't see it because you don't need to see it. The only thing you need to know is that in the metric, there's this factor F, and when you follow through what happens when you look at the action that you get, that you have to extravise to find the shape of that bed sheet, here it is, look at that, it's imaginary. You extremize and you find this equation of motion for R prime describes the derivative of this red curve. And R prime has to be zero somewhere because the bed sheet has to turn around. And you look at this expression for R prime, and the only place where it's zero is where F is zero. And you look at what F is, the only place where F is zero is the horizon. So without actually solving the equations of motion, you learn that this solution, this bed sheet, kisses the horizon. So it knows about the physics that scales T. Okay, you do the calculation, it's easy. There's a subtraction you have to do. There's a little, anyway, it's basically easy. And you find, after you do the right subtraction, that the answer has an L squared piece and a higher order piece, but at small l, this is the dominant term, and you pull out Q hat. Where A here is something involving gamma functions, it's 1.311. So what have we just learned? We've learned that Q hat goes like square root of the Etoff coupling times T cubed times a number that we've calculated. The interesting thing here is that Q hat turns out not to be proportional to some number density of scatterers or to the entropy density, because those are proportional to nc squared. Q hat is dimension 3, so is eta. Eta over s was a beautiful quantity because it was nc independent. Not so here. Q hat over s goes to 0 in the large nc limit. I'll skip this. So Q hat then is better thought of as measuring T cubed than the entropy density. Well, we'd be crazy not to try putting numbers in, so let's do it. And it works out unbelievably close to perfect, which is disturbing, I think. If you evaluate Q hat using the formula that just disappeared, for temperatures of 300 and 400 MeV, you get 5 and 10 GeV squared per Fermi, which is really in the right ballpark. If you do this quantitatively and go through what is the definition of Q hat bar, which is the thing extracted from experiment, in order to get a Q hat bar of 5 GeV squared per Fermi, we need a temperature at the time of one Fermi of 310 MeV. This is surprisingly close to expectations. The expectation, as I'll mention in a minute, is that this should be more like 270 instead of 310, but 270 and 310 are equal at this point. So the main message is that the Q hat from this n equals 4 theory seems to be close to, perhaps slightly less than, but really close to what's needed in comparison with RIC data. So now, well, what are the issues in the comparison? There are issues on the data side, or actually really on the extraction side, not on the data side. The extraction done so far neglects the fact that this high-energy parton feels some transverse wind. It's moving through a flowing medium. That actually means that the extracted Q hat will be greater than the true Q hat, so it will push the extracted Q hat down. The extraction also neglects energy loss from other processes. That also means that the Q hat that you extract is higher than the real one. The LHC will help this because we'll have 100 GeV jets instead of 20 GeV jets, and we'll have many more observables. And what about on the theory side? Well, the first correction to lambda goes to infinity has been calculated. Q hat, here is the first correction away from lambda goes to infinity, and at lambda of 6 pi, this again is tiny. So it's a very small effect. Also, at least in one example, the non-conformality correction has been calculated. Q hat has been calculated in Klebanov-Witten theory. It's not quite the same as that in n equals 4, but it's similar. And in Klebanov-Strassler, which is the non-conformal theory, you can parameterize the result in terms of the deviation of the speed of sound from a third. And if you put in C S squared minus a third of 0.05 as in QCD, that suggests that maybe the corrections due to non-conformality are rather small. But there's certainly no universal combination on the table. What we really want right now are examples of gauge theories with gravity duals where the number of adjoint degrees of freedom is reduced. It's 2 in QCD. It's 16 in N equals 4 super Yang mills. So I think the most interesting thing, not yet in the literature, but close to what's in the literature, is to calculate Q hat in what's called N equals 2 star. Okay. Just to give you a sense of what we're going for here, this is not precision electroweak. Factor of 2 would have a huge impact on heavy ion physics. Suppose after calculating Q hat in many and varied gauge theories with gravity duals, we feel we understand enough to conjecture that in QCD it's some number times square root of lambda times T cubed, and we think we know B to the factor of 2 level. I don't think we're there yet, but I think it's conceivable we could be there. This would have a big impact because it would mean that Q hat is a thermometer for early times with a calibration uncertainty of only 2⅓. This cube really helps you. And thermometers for the early time are hard to come by in heavy ion physics. It would be really, really very, very useful. And to give you a sense of that, I'll end by asking, can we measure this number on the vertical axis here, epsilon over T to the fourth, in experiment? No one has a good way of doing that yet, but jet quenching might yield such a measure, because this number of degrees of freedom, which is epsilon over T to the fourth, is also S over T cubed. S, the entropy density at one Fermi, is actually pretty well known. So if you can use jet quenching to learn T cubed, boom, you've got the number of degrees of freedom. And for your amusement, and it will go on the web page, take the known entropy density, plug in reasonable numbers for the distance traveled through the medium, and if Q hat in QCD really has the same prefactor as in the N equals 4 Young, super Young Mills, and if the measure Q hat from Rick happened to be 3.2 instead of 5, then if all these ifs, the temperature at one Fermi would be 270, you plug that in and you find the number of degrees of freedom is 30, exactly as Lattice QCD says it should be at 1.5 TC. So this, if all of this were to become more solid, you would be able to use the combination of a measure of Q hat and a theoretical understanding of that coefficient B to say that you really were studying a deconfined medium. Okay, the things I did not talk about, other nearby directions being investigated with ADS-CFT. You will hear about this first bullet and the talk after mine from Josh Fries. Josh and his collaborators have been more bold than us. They are trying to treat the whole process of energy loss at strong coupling in N equals 4 rather than just calculating Q hat. This is certainly not a good description for high enough energy partons in QCD, but at RIC, maybe the partons aren't high enough energy yet for my description to be really good, so I think it's certainly plausibly relevant at RIC. At the LHC, energy loss will not be a drag. But the real advantage of their method is that they can ask further questions than we can because they're studying the whole process, they can ask where does the energy go, which is something to which we have no access. The other thing I did not have time to talk about are screening in a hot wind. And this group, including Pavel Koptun, who's in the audience, has calculated the photon emission rate from N equals 4 plasma. I simply don't have time to do these justice. But I want to end by challenging the string theorists in the room. Look farther afield. Those are the nearby things that people are already working on. The question I'll end with, to which I have no answer, is there some gauge theory with a gravity dual in which a zero temperature background, so not a black hole, corresponding to either one or many baryons could be found? So, for example, we'll hear from Rob Myers backgrounds in which mesons can be studied. Can you go from mesons to skirmions to a skirmion crystal? If you can have backgrounds at zero temperature which describe either one baryon or nuclear matter, then calculate Q hat in that background. Then instead of doing deep inelastic scattering off the quark gluon plasma, which is what we've been talking about in the guise of energy loss, is it possible instead to set up deep inelastic scattering off of a baryon or off of cold nuclear matter? In all of these, the idea is that you have a hard probe going through a complicated soft thing, which, whether it's a hadron or nuclear matter or a quark gluon plasma. So you do the ADS-CFT calculation of the hard part, of the difficult part, the soft stuff. If this were possible, I have no idea if it's possible, this could have an impact on another huge area of experimental investigation. The theoretical questions are very murky right now. The buzzwords are small x physics, saturation, color gloss condensate. This, I think, is a big mess, theoretically speaking. It's under intense experimental investigation, and maybe this ADS-CFT methods could clean that up too. I'll stop there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. So you have basically an experimental probe in a sense, very close to the horizon. Can you think of anything that we could experimentally access that actually probes
inside?
Yeah, actually probes the the existence
of a horizon.
Of the horizon itself. In a sense, you're getting arbitrarily close to it.
Right. I think, well, my honest answer to that is no, I can't think of. There are, but one thing which is intriguing in that point, I didn't stress it, but if you look at the self-energy subtraction, so the thing I subtracted, that's a string solution. So you have two isolated strings hanging down vertically from those rails, and they go all the way down to the horizon. They stop at, you know, the integral you do there is from the horizon to the rail. Suppose you just tried to make it go further in. I don't have a good answer to that. I think the answer is that in the frame of reference that we sit in out here at r equals infinity, that would take forever. But so the question is, of course, if you imagine yourself a five-dimensional observer, you just fall through the horizon in finite proper time. So is there any observable from infinity that correlates with the fact that if you were a five-dimensional observer, you would fall through in finite time? And I don't know the answer. I don't know of one, but...
Yeah. There's also the fact that if this really is sort of dual to a black hole, it decays ultimately, right? So it's going to evaporate away. And in a sense, you're getting access to the states inside the horizon when that
happens. Well, there have been attempts... If you think of a real heavy ion collision, of course, this hot stuff doesn't sit there very long. It expands rapidly, and hence cools. And the black hole that we're studying is a description of equilibrated matter at temperature T existing there forever. You can also ask, can you come up with an ADS-CFT description that actually models the dynamics of a heavy ion collision? Now, what we've done is... It's the analog of when you think of deep inelastic scattering, you have the hard parts that are under control, and then you have parton distribution functions. Okay, and Q hat is like a parton distribution function. It's the soft non-perturbative thing. The rest is perturbative and under control. Now, but if you get more bold, and in fact even more bold than Friis et al., and try and Friis et al. Are describing the drag on a quark moving through this quark gluon plasma that's at a constant temperature live forever. Now, suppose you try and describe a heavy ion collision, where the temperature... So Shuryak and Zahed have tried that. I would call that paper, what are the right adjectives, bold and pioneering. It's not at the same level of rigor of the kinds of things that we've been doing, but maybe other people should look at it. Can you actually describe dynamics where you have a black hole which is cooling off, not because of Hawking radiation, but because of expansion? So it has to be finite in spatial extent, expanding. I think it'd be pretty hard to do it rigorously.
Yeah, certainly people have thought about that kind of configuration in ADS-CFT.
Yes, so. Yes. There's this work by Minwala et al., which is very... The work by Minwala et al. Is... it's crucial to their description that NC really is infinite. If you look at what they did and ask what would happen for NC of 3, it's quite different. But we can talk about that afterwards.
We're over time, but let's take one more.
Oh, this is... Let me say, I should have mentioned, this is Arthur Habecker, N years ago, framed deep inelastic scattering in terms of Wilson loops. So.
I didn't want to come back to this old stuff. I have almost forgot about it. I was curious to ask something about your first issue, the old story, the nicety of the old story.
Yes.
To appreciate that better, I would like to understand it more parametrically. At the moment, it looks to me that you're having an order one number in both sides, one measured, the other order one in n equals to 4. I mean, 1 over 4 pi happens to be small, but it doesn't look to me as... in any sense parametrically small, just happens to be one-tenth.
Right.
Now, if you calculate an order one number in two different theories, I would say that any coincidence is just accidental and you have no reason to expect to learn anything from that. Am I missing something? Is there some parametrical way that you can learn the theories are actually similar and this number has to be small parametrically on both sides?
So Pavel is an author of this work, so at some point if the microphone can go back to Pavel, I'll give him a chance. But the way what I would say is that there is actually a pretty good answer to that question for the shear viscosity story. If you ask me the same question for jet quenching, I just have to say I agree with you. I see no reason on the jet quenching side why the Q hat you calculated at n equals 4 comes out so close to what you get from QCD. In fact, I would have expected them to miss by some factor on the order of the ratio of 16 to 2. So it's really important on the jet quenching side to study more theories and see how much that number changes. On the shear viscosity side, on the other hand, folks including Pavel have, folks including Pavel have shown that there's this universality. So many different theories which happen to have a gravity dual all get 1 over 4 pi. The Amitov coupling corrections are small. The only weakness, I would say, the biggest weakness in going from the 1 over 4 pi to the real world is that the calculations are all done at large NC, and the real world has NC of 3, and nobody knows how big the 1 over NC corrections are. But I think their story is pretty impressively robust after 3 or 4 years of poking at it now. Okay. Does Pavel want to add anything?
Okay, probably we should move on to the next talk, which is Josh Fries. We've had quite an introduction to that talk, actually. He will tell us about ADS-CFT and the relativistic heavy ion collider.